Good evening, everybody, and thank you very much for joining us for this fourth session in our Word Alive Creation Seminar Series. You're all very welcome here, and just a quick recap for those of you who may have missed the previous session. In the previous session, we talked about we actually started digging into creation, finally, after laying the foundation, we started talking about the actual creation of the world, what the Bible has to say about what God did on that creation week. And we got up to day 4. God had already created the plants and the dry land on day 3. And then he waited until day 4 to make the sun, moon, and the stars. And we're going to talk a bit about that today. And we started examining two questions about the sun, moon, and stars. Question one was, has science actually disproven the Genesis account of creation? I hear that often. Science has disproven all that, the creation in 6 literal days. And question number two, is it really logically absurd for God to do it the way he did? A lot of people just simply can't believe what Genesis says because it seems so ridiculous that God would make the earth and then wait 3 days to make the solar system around the earth. Wouldn't it make much more sense to make the sun and the other planets and then make an earth and plop it in there? You know, and then put some plants on the earth because the plants kind of need the sun, and at least they do today. So I think we addressed that first question, I think, in some detail. No, the Genesis account of creation has not been scientifically disproven. Absolutely not. Actually, Chad has infinitely more on that topic, and I think he's going to share yet in days to come. But no, science has nothing to say about this. Question number two, is it really logically absurd? Why did God do it the way he did? Well, we know God made the sun, moon, and stars. We know why he made them, to give us a clock calendar system for days, seasons, and years. It tells us for signs, seasons, days, and years. It tells us in Genesis 1. But why did he wait until day 4? Well, I think I have an answer to that for what it may be worth. If you take a look at the sky, it's without a question, the sun is definitely the most awe-inspiring object that's up there, for sure. And I think ancient man had, well, I know for a fact, ancient man had a terrible problem with sun worship. And can you think of anything more awe-inspiring than this great glowing disc that comes up morning after morning? It comes up, it dispels the darkness and the cold, it keeps things alive for now. Sure, people have a problem worshiping the sun. And all through history, people had a problem worshiping the sun. Actually, the book of Job, chapter 31, it comments on this. Job himself, he says, if I beheld the sun when it shined, or the moon walking in brightness, and my heart hath been secretly enticed, or my mouth has kissed my hand, and I think the NIV says, my hand offered a kiss of homage. This also were an iniquity to be punished by the judge, for I should have denied the God that is above. You know, Job was saying, I am not going to regard the sun in its radiance. Job understood that people in his day and people today don't think we're immune in North America. I'm going to get to that in just a minute. There is sun worship going on that has always gone on. In ancient Egypt, for example, the sun worshiper Pharaoh Akhenaten convinced all of Egypt to start worshiping the one god, the sun god. You know, there's the Babylonian sun god Shamash. Over in Peru, the Ica culture, they were worshiping the sun. I mean, it's just all over the place. And the fact is, there's sun worship going on right now in Winnipeg. Can you believe it? In Winnipeg right now, and it's not by some tribal people, ignorant savages someplace. This is by the people who are most esteemed in academia. They have sun worship sessions going on right now. Actually, usually begins in September. And it'll go to about June. Sun worship services. Right? You're looking at me like, what is he talking about? Well, you just come with me to any classroom that is teaching earth science, and we're going to get involved in a sun worship service. Okay? Here's Life Science Library, New York, 1964. You can pick up any textbook anyway. You know, I just picked this one at random. Look what it says about life, about the sun. It says, life, wherever it exists, is a product of starlight. In the beginning, as now, it was the steady flow of energy from the sun that made life possible on the earth. Can you read that? So the sun is what makes it possible to have life here. Don't need God, just need the sun. It says, from 93 million miles away, its power reached down to initiate chemical reactions that form the primitive stuff of life. Ah, the sun is the creator. Remember, in the last session, we talked about how the sun created the earth, and now the sun's creating life. It says, the warming sunlight provided a steady climate, mild enough to encourage the experiment of living. Wow. This young people's book of Planet Earth, 1999, it says when time does run out for Earth, it will probably be because the hydrogen at the heart of our sun has been exhausted. As the sun dies, it will begin to swell into a bloated red giant, and in a few thousand years, it will engulf the Earth and scorch away the atmosphere, oceans, and eventually all life. Okay, so get this, folks. According to scientists, the sun created us. The sun created the Earth, it created life, and it is the ultimate determiner of our destiny. That is God. Okay, end of sun worship service. God is a jealous God. He made this. I think God did it. I know God did it on purpose. Everything he did in the book of Genesis is deliberate and emphatic. I don't need the sun to make the plants, says God. I don't need the sun to make the earth. And I'm sure that God has done this so that his people will make a decision on who their authority is. The rest of the planet says the sun came first and then the earth. And God says, as a matter of fact, the earth came first. You decide who you believe. And I'm just going to believe him, you know. And if I'm wrong, then I'll say, Lord, I just believe what you put in your book. But if you're a professing Christian who just can't believe what God has clearly wrote because the opinions of man have gotten to you, what are you going to tell the judge? What are you going to tell the Lord? I saw what you clearly wrote, Lord, but I just couldn't believe it because all the scientists, the godless humanistic scientists, you know. Isaiah 42:8. Our great God says, I am the Lord, that is my name, my glory I will not give to another, neither my praise to graven images. We are not to worship the sun and give it the credit due God. And so we're fighting very hard against that. God is the one who made the stars. This is an interesting picture here. This is, they call this Hubble Deep Field North. They took the Hubble Space Telescope, they trained it on a patch of sky no bigger than a grain of sand, the size of a grain of sand held at arm's length. And they thought there was no stars in that little patch of sky. They focused the Hubble telescope for 10 days. When they got back the images of what was there, they found more stars than they could count. How did those stars all get there? The evolutionist says that, well, gas and dust, they sort of, a gravitational attraction of these things sort of compressed them together, and over millions of years, these things are going to get hotter and hotter and hotter, and voila, you have a star. The star will ignite. And it'll go through a life cycle, and they have all this mapped out on paper, but no one's ever seen any of this happen. We see some bright spots in some nebula, but no measurements to show us that stars are actually forming. You just gotta ask the questions here, you know. It might be that there are stars behind that dust cloud, you know. If the emperor has no clothes, the emperor has no clothes. And if they're trying to convince us that stars form, and this is the best evidence that they have, there's an infinite problem with getting dust and gas to condense in on it. Plenty of dust and gas out there. I don't see any of it coming together and condensing. The problem is, as dust comes together, it gets hotter. And when things get hotter, they want to what? Expand. And there's a huge problem. This astronomer said, there have been a number of suggestions to get the process started, and almost all of them require stars to start with. And so the idea is that, you know, stars in a particular region may explode, and the shockwave forces gas together and might ignite a star. But the problem is, you got to start with stars. It's the chicken and the egg problem. It cannot account for the origin of stars in the first place. And I got tons of quotes here from different scientists, not the propagandists, not the textbook writers, but the real scientists here, the cosmologists, who are trying to figure out what's going on. Ivan Peterson wrote in Science News, no one has unambiguously observed material falling into an embryonic star. If anyone tells you that they've seen stars form, they just don't know what they're talking about. This should be happening if star formation is still going on. And no one has caught a molecular cloud in the act of collapsing. Fred Whipple wrote in his book, The Mystery of Comets, astronomers have yet to find an interstellar cloud in the actual process of collapse. No, they don't have any evidence, folks. This is a quote from Science Magazine, May 1990. The origin of stars represents one of the most fundamental unsolved problems in contemporary astrophysics. No one really understands how star formation proceeds. It's really quite remarkable. Well, we see lots of stars blowing up. We don't see any of them forming. You'd expect star births to at least equal star deaths. And there are zillions of stars. Well, God said he did it. Why couldn't he do it? You alone are the Lord. You have made the heaven and the heaven of heavens and all their host. Hey, God did it. One way or another, it's going to take a miracle to make a star. A miracle, according to Webster's, is a wonderful happening contrary to the laws of nature. To get a star to form, you've got to do something contrary to the laws of nature. Okay? You're going to have to do something contrary to the laws of nature to make life come from inanimate matter, too. And we're going to get to that tonight, God willing. Tons more on stars. Chad's going to share with us another time. One of the things I want to mention right now is this thing called the red shift. When we look at stars from far away, especially, we can run their light through a spectroscope, and we can separate colors that are being, or separate the light into colors that are being emitted from that star. And little black bands show up on the spectrograph. Those are absorption lines. They tell us what elements are in that star. Okay? Very interesting. Stars that appear far away, they have their black lines shifted to the red side of the spectrum. Why is that? See, the red side is the longer wavelengths, lower energy. The blue side is quicker wavelengths, okay, shorter wavelengths, greater energy. How do we account for this? Well, many scientists believe that the universe is expanding, and as the star moves away, its light is being stretched, and the wavelengths of light are becoming longer, hence redder. They call it the Doppler effect. And you hear the sound. If a train comes, you know, whistling towards you, you get this, you know, and then as it passes, you know, it starts to go, it's because the wavelengths are going longer. We think that light might be happening like that. That light may be behaving that way. I'm not so sure about that. I'm not convinced. I'm not saying it isn't happening. I'm just not convinced by that. May have something to do with God stretching out the heavens. Jeremiah 10 and many other places talks about God stretching out the heavens at creation. By his wisdom, he has stretched out the heavens. Job 9:8, he alone spreads out the heavens. You see that? Isaiah 45, God says, my hands have stretched the heavens. What is going on there? Lots of models to explain what we're seeing in the universe. Are any of them right? Maybe none of them are right. But lots of models to explain the universe, what we're seeing with the red shift and starlight. Very, very congruent with what the Bible says. Okay? It's not like we don't have an explanation for these things. As a matter of fact, we have more than we can choose from. I favor Barry Satterfield's model for what's going on there in the world. Barry Satterfield feels that God had stretched the heavens initially at creation, and that there was stored energy in the fabric of space. And over the lifetime of the universe, that energy is being released into the universe, and it is affecting the way atoms are emitting light. And when the atoms reach a certain threshold, they begin to produce a greater wavelength of light. Everything becomes blue shifted. So when you're looking at stars that are far away, you're looking at that old light. You're looking at red shifted light. It has nothing to do with stars moving away from you. It has everything to do with the way atoms are behaving in response to this extra energy flow. And if you want more on that, just visit Satterfield.org for a lot more on that. But I think his model makes a lot of sense. And I could talk more about that another time, perhaps. But lots of models out there to explain what we're seeing. God says he made the stars and he made them to put light on the earth. And that leads us to this great question that many people have. How is it that we see starlight from so far away? How is it that, you know, a star that's, you know, 200 million light years away can be showing its light here if the earth is only a few thousand years old? Again, lots of ways to answer the question. I question whether or not those stars are really that far to start with. They might be that far. I'm just not convinced. The way they measure stars, for example, the first step is parallax trigonometry, where they look at a star at one time in the year, and 6 months later they're going to look at it again, and they're going to create a triangle there, if you can catch that. See the Earth on opposite sides of its orbit 6 months later? We create a base to the triangle, and we can calculate the two angles that make up the base, and we can use trigonometry to figure out the angle of the third point, the star. And that's the first step, as far as I know. There might be other ways, but that's a common one. All these textbooks seem to talk about it. The problem is, if a star was only one light year away, and apparently none of them are that close, that would be like me standing beside Chad, for example, 16 inches apart, and we're going to focus in on a dot 8 1/4 miles away. That is a very skinny triangle. I don't know if you can, maybe you can calculate that angle. That is a very, very small angle. Now, what if our star is 100 light years away? Let's say 100. Well, that's like me and Chad standing 16 inches apart, and our third point that we got to calculate is 824 miles away. That's something like, you know, Chad and I are going to stand in Grand Forks, 16 inches apart, and we're going to look at a dot up there in Churchill someplace. I don't know that that's measurable. I'm not sure. I don't know that you can be certain about where the Earth was on the other side of the sun, to tell you the truth. Maybe they can measure those things. I don't know. But we have to understand, we don't know too much about light. apparently gravity can affect light. The whole theory of a black hole is that it has so much gravity that it's going to pull light into itself. Okay, lots of things are affecting light and the way light behaves, and as light travels these great distances to get to us, we're not really sure what we're looking at. Okay? Not even light can escape a black hole, they say. I suspect that the speed of light has been slowing. That's part of Setterfield's model, by the way. I think things have been happening over the universe's history to slow the speed of light. And a lot of astronomers and cosmologists are catching on to this now. This is from the Winnipeg Free Press. They published an article on this, saying the speed of light may have been slowing. They actually can slow it down. In the laboratory, this is from February 1999, some scientists at Harvard, they managed to slow light to 38 miles an hour. Light usually travels 186,000 miles a second. They managed to slow it down to 38 miles an hour. And then in the year 2000, they got it down to 1 mile an hour and then released it like an ordinary particle. Here's some scientists in 2001 brought it to a full stop in the lab and then released it. "We have succeeded in holding a light pulse still without taking all the energy away from it," said this Harvard physicist. And then they're able to speed it up too. This is from June 2000. This is from the New York Times. They managed to speed up the speed of light 300 times in the laboratory. This is from Walt Brown's book. He comments on some of Setterfield's research. It says, "During the past 300 years, 164 separate measurements on the speed of light have been published. 16 different techniques were used. Astronomer Barry Setterfield of Australia has studied the measurements, especially their precision and experimental errors. His results show that the speed of light has apparently decreased so rapidly, experimental error cannot explain it." Apparently, the speed of light has been slowing down. I think it has. There's the graph that Setterfield has constructed. You can see more on that on his website. But it's not just him. Many other scientists, secular scientists, also postulate that the speed of light has been slowing. This scientist says, "We have shown how a time-varying speed of light could provide resolution to the well-known cosmological puzzles." Okay, what are they talking about here? According to the Big Bang, nothing exploded, and then it became everything. But the something, whatever it was, it expanded faster than the speed of light. Even they believe that energy moved faster than light speed. They can't actually explain all that. I can't explain it. But the problem is, no matter where you look in the universe from planet Earth, no matter how far you look that way or that way, the universe seems to be uniform. The same laws of physics are applying, the same temperature, it appears the same temperature. Everything seems to be pretty even. This is only possible in a Big Bang universe if light travels faster than it does today, because there's not enough time in the universe's history, according to the evolutionist even, for energy to get from one side to the other. Okay, they call it the horizon problem, the flatness problem. This is from the London Sunday Times. Science correspondent here writes, "This would only be possible for light to cross from one side to the other if it traveled much faster than today's moments after the universe was created. And the hypothesis of this scientist suggests that it was so fast that it could have been traveling at 186,000 miles a second multiplied by a figure with 70 zeros after it." Now that's fast. Pretty fast. Lots of articles coming out that the speed of light may have changed throughout the universe's history. There's no physical law that prohibits this. Okay? Tons on this. The shocking possibility is that the speed of light might change in time during the life of the universe. See that? This is a Russian cosmologist. He says the speed of light was 10 billion times faster at time zero. Okay? Not a problem to get light from point A to point B like that, if God wanted it to, you know. The speed of light was apparently exceeded by as much as a factor of 100. God can do anything he wants. I'm going to tell you, I believe what the Bible says. I don't care what the scientists say. If they happen to agree with what the Bible's saying, well, great. Hooray, I'll use them. If they disagree, too bad. You're on your own. God can do anything he wants. God can make things travel from here to there like that. Not a problem. Do you remember Acts chapter 8 when Philip baptizes the Ethiopian eunuch? I know it's a nice picture there. He baptizes the eunuch in Gaza. Remember that? And then it says that the Spirit caught Philip away and he was found at Azotus. Just like that. The Spirit caught him away, raptured him. That's the word. 20 miles away, he was found at Azotus. Interesting. What if you were in that town walking around and you saw Philip preaching? "Hey, Philip, where were you?" "Oh, I was just down at Gaza. I was just baptizing a guy." "Oh, yeah. When was that? Oh, about 10 seconds ago. How did you get from here to there so fast, Philip? God can handle the problem. God can handle the problem. So when we look at the stars, we shouldn't get intimidated. The light speed problem is not a problem. The distance of stars is not a problem. The idea that stars are evolving is not a problem. They're not. Okay? I have much more on this, on all this, on our website. I know I'm talking fast, but for you folks who are watching DVD, you can just rewind it. And you can shut me up anytime you want to. But these folks, they're, they have to bear the burden. So, I'm going to end there on stars, and we're going to start talking about planet Earth again. But if much more on that, you can consult our ministry for much more on that. All right, that was day 4. Now, on day 5, the Bible says that God created the big things, the whales and the birds. Evolution says evolution doesn't even care about God. Evolution says nature started with the little things, the amoebas, you know, the squiggly little things. As a matter of fact, God says, no, I started with the huge things. Whales, you know, the most obvious thing you've ever laid eyes on, and the birds. Now we have a real conflict. God is so emphatic and so deliberate about what he says he did. According to evolution, the birds evolved from the reptiles, the land reptiles. But God has got the birds coming before the land animals. See how God has done that? And the evolutionist says, well, the amphibians crawled out of the ocean, or the fish came out of the ocean, became amphibians, became mammals, first reptiles, then mammals, then the mammals headed back to the water and became the whales. God says, I don't need the mammals to make a whale. I don't need reptiles to make a whale. As a matter of fact, I can make whales like that. And he did. So the geologic time scale, the geologic column that is the Bible to the evolutionist is absolutely contradictory to what the Bible says Earth history is really all about. Again, God has just locked us in. We've got to make a choice. I recommend it to you that you just take God at his word. That's what I'm going to do. Let's take a look. The evolutionist says, no, things started small. A gelatinous blob of some sort. Some single-celled organism. And he is our common ancestor. Everything's related to this one mystery organism. And this is from the National Geographic, the little tree there, showing how everything is related to everything else. This textbook says, where there is still no life, but swirling in the waters of the oceans is a bubbling broth of complex chemicals. Progress from a complex chemical soup to a living organism is very slow. I don't know how they could know that. No one's ever watched it happen. How could you possibly know that? This textbook says, all the many forms of life on Earth today are descended from a common ancestor found in a population of primitive unicell organisms. And then it says, no traces of those events remain. Right? No traces of those events remain. Scientists cannot travel backward in time to witness what happened. Yeah, I agree. You can't. Ridiculous. Michael Behe wrote a book, it was a groundbreaking book on the origin of life from non-living chemicals. He himself is a biochemist. He said molecular evolution is not based on scientific authority. And he goes on to say that nobody has given a detailed explanation, an evolutionary explanation for how living things could have been created by non-living matter, by natural forces alone. No one has published on that. They just don't know. And I got tons of textbooks at home that just don't know. They shy away from it. If they comment at all, they just say, well, we're not going to cover it. You know, I think I just read some of that at our last CARE meeting. Louis Pasteur, well, you see, Darwin was operating from an area of very low visibility. Darwin did not know a whole lot about living things. He did not know about molecular biology at all. He looked into a pond. He saw squiggly little things in a pond. And, well, maybe life just evolved in a pond. They did not know how infinitely complex living things really are. But while he was cooking up his story, there was a Frenchman over in Paris, Louis Pasteur. And the next time you drink pasteurized milk, you just thank God for this Frenchman. Because Louis Pasteur, while Darwin was writing his stuff, Pasteur was demolishing evolution forever. And Pasteur showed, with his experiments, he showed that living things do not spontaneously generate. You know, non-living material will not just come together and form a living system. And he proved it. He took a flask with a medium in it that could sustain microorganisms. And he had nothing living in there, but he just left it open to the elements. And in a couple days, stuff was living in there. And then he took an identical flask, but this one he sealed. And there are flasks today that you can go take a look at that still have nothing growing in them. And he proved right there that non-living materials are not going to just sort of arrange themselves into living systems. That's the, you know, the law of biogenesis. Living things will produce living things, and that's it. That's all we've ever seen. He says the doctrine of spontaneous generation will never recover from the mortal blow of this simple experiment. And he's right. He says there is no circumstance known which confirms that microbeings have come into the world without germs, without parents resembling themselves. Living things are needed to make a living thing. And all scientists will agree. This is from a science textbook I have at home. It says, it's also known as the principle of biogenesis. The principle explains that all organisms arrive from living parents. The concept is firmly established in biology today. No argument. Yet, you know, the textbook goes on, yet, according to the evolution theory, life did ultimately originate from non-living molecules. That is by abiogenesis. So we've got to abandon a scientific principle that's well established and latch on to some faith-based system that I would just like to add that has hopelessness written all over it. You know, atheistic evolution has hopelessness written all over it. David Herrick Grinspoon, he was the astronomer that I quoted in our previous slideshow. He doesn't believe in God. He tells you he just can't stand creationism or Christians. But he says when it comes to the origin of life, they really don't know how life got here. And he says this idea that life just evolved on its own, he says maybe in some sense it's not natural, it's not science, but natural philosophy. He's at least, you know, going to admit that. And if you read his book, he uses all sorts of flowery language to explain how life got here. He says it got here through magic. You know, it's a beautiful magic that living things could be produced by natural forces. And yeah, but that's not good enough. That's not good enough for me. The cell is so infinitely complex. The cell is the smallest unit of, I guess, the smallest thing that you could consider living would be one cell. And this thing is so infinitely complex. You can go get a science textbook, and you're going to see an atlas of one of these things. I mean, a real atlas, like you'd see of a city, with thousands of complex systems and structures, all interdependent, working together to make this thing live. This textbook says, to sustain the varied existence, the cell utilizes a tightly organized system of parts that is very much like a tiny industrial complex. Wow. Just like any manufacturer does, the cell takes simple materials and transforms them into complex substances. And just as a manufacturer must be prepared to deliver his product to customers, so some cells deliver their materials where needed. Incredible. You think that just happened by chance? In a universe where everything you lay eyes on is falling apart, how in the world did something this complex spring into being without intelligent help? Absolutely. You know, it's almost a waste of time to stand here and talk about something so obvious. You know, the most complex thing in the room is us, folks. You know, and you would never dream that the computer just evolved. But it's not nearly as complex as we are. Why would we think that we could just evolve, that living things could just evolve? I like Behe's, he's got a neat analogy here. He talks about the mousetrap. The mousetrap's job is to catch mice. That's what it's designed to do. The mousetrap needs everything it's got to do the job. It's not going to catch mice if you take any of those parts away from it. Okay? That's called irreducible complexity. Well, a living cell is much the same way. It needs all its stuff. All those thousands of systems and structures have got to be there for the cell to do what it's supposed to do, and that's live. So how could Darwinian evolution, slow step-by-step process over millions of years, how could you achieve that? There would be nothing there to select. No? This primitive cell that's half alive, it's not even alive yet, it's not going to hang around for 10 million years waiting for all its parts to just slowly, you know, accrue and accumulate. Take a look at this. This is a little motor that's attached to the bacteria. This is the little propeller that drives the bacteria. It's got rods and bushings. It's a technology. Staggering to behold. And it needs all its stuff to do its job. 8 million of these things would fit across the circular cross-section of one of your hairs. 8 million. This thing is so small, it runs like an electrical motor, but it doesn't run on electron flow. It's so small, it runs on proton flow. Now that's one of the amazing things I think about this universe is no matter, when you pick up something that man has made and you magnify it and you keep magnifying it, it gets rougher and rougher and rougher and coarser and coarser. But you pick up something that God has made, and it gets more and more complex and more fine and more beautiful. Amazing, amazing technology. In a universe, mind you, where everything is falling apart. That is that deadly second law of thermodynamics. But you take a look at the technology behind that flagella, and your mouth has got to just drop. How do they explain such a thing? Well, some scientists say, well, some of those parts appear, you know, elsewhere in the cell. It could be, you know, they have other functions. Uh-huh. There's 40 basic components in that flagella. Okay? Only 10 of them are found elsewhere in the cell. The rest are unique to that structure. It's got to have them to do what it does. And the evolutionary literature is silent on this, and it's silent on many things. Now, a few years back, there was headlines went around the world that life was made in the lab. And this happy guy here, you see his machine that he built. He said he created life in the laboratory. We have a replica of this at the Manitoba Museum. You can go have a look at it and read all the propaganda if you like. I'm glad that you're here first, though, to get the straight goods on it. Miller was convinced that life evolved, as, you know, most evolutionists are. It evolved without God. So he created this, an artificial atmosphere based solely on chemistry. It had nothing to do with geology. They just knew what chemicals were going to produce the product they were looking for. So they said, well, early Earth must have had this atmosphere. And then he ran the atmosphere through an energy source, a couple sparks. And then he had a little trap at the bottom where he caught the elements that he created. And what he got down there were a couple amino acids. It knocked the world's socks off. Amino acids are the basic building blocks for proteins. And you're made up of proteins. So, headlines, you know, we made life in the laboratory. They didn't do any such thing, you know. They got a couple amino acids. They got mostly tar, mostly tar and acid, and a very minute amount of amino acids at the bottom. The fact is they had to put a little trap at the bottom of the thing to isolate the aminos, because if they went through again, the same energy that made them would destroy them. So on an early Earth, can you just imagine, you know, who is coaxing along these experiments anyways, you know? The lightning flashing that this is trying to imitate here would just wipe out those aminos that it created anyways. I want you to notice that he had no oxygen. He said, we cannot have oxygen present, or we're not going to get any of the quantity of these amino acids that we're looking for. His atmosphere contained ammonia, water vapor, and methane. He says oxygen would simply destroy our product, so we just can't have oxygen. But the geologists say we have no evidence that the Earth was without oxygen. It looks like the Earth always had oxygen. And by the way, oxygen makes up our ozone layer. And if you don't have oxygen, then the UV radiation is just going to destroy his amino acids anyways. It's the chicken and egg problem. With oxygen in the atmosphere, you don't get your amino acids, sadly. And without the oxygen, UV radiation will destroy your amino acids, Stanley. What are you going to do? This is from the National Geographic, March 1998. It says, many scientists now suspect that the early atmosphere was different from what Stanley Miller had first supposed. They think it consisted of hydrogen, methane, and ammonia. Oh, so they think it consisted of carbon dioxide and nitrogen rather than methane and ammonia. And the article says that's bad news for chemists. Why is that? Because when they try sparking carbon dioxide and nitrogen, they get a paltry amount of organic molecules, the equivalent of dissolving a drop of food coloring in a swimming pool. Scientists find it hard to imagine life evolving from such a diluted soup. I agree. And so the article, if you just continue reading, they think that maybe life came from outer space. Comets brought life here, you know, the seeds of life. Wow, you know. See, they're just pushing the problem out there now. But life has not been made in the laboratory. Now, never mind, they got infinite problems making a protein. Never mind the complex genetic material in your cells. There's a language inside your cells. The cells of your body contain all the information it takes to make you. And all living things have the DNA code, a distinctive DNA code pattern, a language that gets read by other components in the cell and translated, and the instructions are followed to build what that DNA says that cell needs to build. The chemicals and the proteins, absolutely staggering in its complexity and order. This is Richard Dawkins, who says, anyone who believes in creation is wicked, evil, or stupid, or all three. That's what he said. But look what he says about the cell. He says each cell nucleus contains a digitally coded database, larger in information than 30 volumes of Encyclopedia Britannica. And this figure is for each cell, not all the cells of the body put together. Some species of the unjustly called primitive amoebas have as much information in their DNA as 1,000 volumes of Encyclopedia Britannica. Information. Information, mind you. This information scientist here, Hubert Hockey, he says it's important to understand that we're not reasoning by analogy here. The sequence hypothesis applies directly to the protein and to the genetic text as well as to written language. When we're looking at DNA, you're looking at information, real information, and that is important. It's important to understand this because information is more than the stuff it's written on. That is so important that you get this. Please understand this. I can take a pen and paper and write something. I can write information down, but the information is more than the pen and the paper. The pen and the paper did not produce the information. I did. And I can take that information and I can put it on my computer if I want to. I could write it in the sky if I wasn't scared of flying. Okay? I can write it in the sand. The same information. That proves that the information is more than the medium that it's expressed on. And the information in the DNA is more than the chemicals of the DNA. Okay? It has an origin someplace in someone's mind. And that person is God. Before the Word became flesh, before He was expressed in a physical medium, the Word was with God. Okay? The second person of the triune Godhead. Jesus. The Word. The information. The one who reveals God to us. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word became flesh. You see that? So the information you see in living things has an origin. And it's beyond the material it's expressed on. That's what I'm trying to share with you. And make no mistake about it. Jesus Christ is God. I'm battling Mormons right now on this topic. Jesus is the God. Absolutely. Okay, one of the problems, we can't go into all the origin of life problems, but we're going to hit the high points here. One of the problems they have is that there is no way to make all the chemicals you find in a living thing in a prebiotic, you know, environment. That is, by just letting natural forces do their thing, you just cannot build all the chemicals you need. And that is an infinite problem. You've got to have at least your stuff there, and they can't do it in the lab. Okay, I'm going to read all these quotes here. The other problem they have is, living things are made up of proteins. And to get proteins to form, you've got to get amino acids to form. All the right amino acids, mind you, and there's many of them. They got to form in the right sequences. They got to link together in chains. They got to make the right three-dimensional configuration so that they can lock into the right structures and they can do the right stuff. I mean, it's just infinitely complex. But even to get amino acids to link together, the process involves producing a water molecule. And water, it's a depolymerizer. It's gonna break these things apart too. You just need this. All this has to happen inside a living thing that can govern all these activities. Okay, it's not gonna happen outside of a living organism, and that's a huge problem. The other problem is amino acids come in many different varieties, but each variety comes in two different shapes. You gotta have not only the right variety, but it's gotta come in the right shape, and it's gotta link together with others in the right sequence, and then the directional properties will hopefully make this thing fold into the right three-dimensional configuration. The problems are staggering, okay? Dean Kenyon, he was a tenured professor of biology, he was in a courtroom defending creation. He says, no one can say we have found a naturalistic explanation for the origin of life. Instead, these isomer preferences point to biochemical creation. He's saying, there is no way that natural forces are going to select out the right amino acids for the job, the right shape and the right sequence. There is no way, and no one has ever published a paper showing that they could. Okay? And this guy actually you can't believe the persecution that this man faced because he favored creation. How about the cross-reaction problems? Even if you could get all the necessary chemicals in one place, which they cannot, but even if you could, that doesn't mean they're just going to assemble themselves into a living system. Just because I got hammer and nails and boards and stuff sitting in my basement, that doesn't mean they're going to assemble themselves into a birdhouse or something. It takes energy to make these things happen, intelligent energy. This is from Walter Bradley and Charles Thaxton. It's difficult to imagine how amino acids could be either concentrated in solution or selectively absorbed on surfaces such as clays before they were consumed in chemical reactions with other substances in the prebiotic soup. When they mix all these things together, all they get is tar. You never get anything good coming out of it. These things are reacting harmfully with each other, these chemicals. You need that DNA to instruct the living organism what to do with those chemicals. Very, very important. Okay? One last thing about living things. Living things need their chemicals to survive. They produce what they need. Okay? So let's say chemical D is the thing that the cell needs to live. It needs it. It's not going to live without it. So this thing takes chemicals from the environment, and in a very complex chemical cascade, it creates chemical D. But first, it goes through all these transitions. It becomes chemical A, and all this enzymatic action has to happen. And finally, it becomes chemical B, and then finally C. This complex chemical pathways just cannot be explained by Darwinian evolution. You know, evolution by steps over millions of years. This cell needs it, that chemical, and it needs it now.
How in the world did it evolve this long, complex chemical cascade of reactions? I mean, complex here. This puts the work of a carpenter into the shadows. Sorry, chat. But I'm telling you, cells need their chemicals, and they need to govern those chemicals, too. You know, I know people in my family who have diabetes. Okay, but that's because the regulatory system has failed. The cell not only has to make these things, it has to regulate them, or the cell dies. You just can't imagine a way in which natural process alone, without intelligence, could come up with such a thing. Staggers the imagination. Absolutely staggers the imagination. Hubert Hawke wrote, "The origin of life by chance in a primeval soup is impossible. The practical person must conclude that life did not happen by chance." I agree. Behe concluded his book. He said, "Scientists working on the origin of life deserve a lot of credit. They have attacked the problem by experiment and calculation, as science should. And although the experiments have not turned out as many hoped, through their efforts, we now have a clear idea of the staggering difficulties that would face an origin of life by natural chemical process." The guy who believes that living things evolved without intelligence, they have a faith that puts mine into the shadows. They really do. Absolutely incredible. And there are scientists that have said, Robert Shapiro said, "I will never believe in God, and I don't care what they find or don't find." You know? I mean, when this guy goes to hell, which he's going to if he doesn't get right with God, who can blame God? God is not going to pull this guy into his heaven when all he wanted in life was nothing to do with God. He's going to give him what he asked for. Well, one thing's for sure, let's not live by this ridiculous notion that Christians are blind in our faith. We are not blind in our faith, that's for sure. This textbook says, "At this time, however, no one can say whether any theory is right or wrong. What can be said is that somehow, through some process, the chemicals that make up living things did group themselves together and form the first cells." Wow, look at that. They just explain everything to us. Hey, how about that? They explain a thing. Ridiculous. What kind of place was primordial? This National Geographic reminds me of the story of Elijah and the prophets of Baal. Scientists are working so hard right now trying to figure out how evolution did it. That's their God, you know. And just like the prophets of Baal, they were crying out to their reluctant God, "Oh, Baal, hear us." And they cried out for, you know, all day long and started cutting themselves to get some sympathy from their reluctant God, and nothing. And that's just like the evolutionists of today. Evolution, show us how you did it. And evolution is silent. And you know why he's silent? He's silent for the same reason that Baal was silent. This is the worst problem that a God would ever have to face. And his problem is he doesn't exist. That's the problem. And you got to exist to do or say something. You know, it helps. All these scientists working so hard to make life in the laboratory, all this intelligent efforts and all the money, and they feel that if they can just produce a single speck of living substance, man, they can just prove to the world that no intelligence was necessary from the beginning to make living things. And does anyone see, a problem with that kind of reasoning? Here are the modern-day priests of Baal. Professing to be wise, the Bible says they became fools. These guys call... In the next session, we'll probably talk about the evolution of mankind. We're going to start getting into that. They call us Homo sapiens, wise man. But actually, today they call us Homo sapiens sapien. You know, man, wise, wise. Professing to be wise, they became fools. My father is not a rock. Actually, my father is a rock, if you come to think of it. But not the rock that the evolutionists believe in, that's for sure. Biology textbook says, the birds evolve from the reptiles. Remember, God said on day 5, he made birds and whales. We're going to talk about birds and whales here until this hour runs out, and then I'm going to be quiet. But we're going to go for it. We're going to take a running start at this. Birds are the descendants of dinosaurs. Bird feathers evolve from the same scales that protected the dinosaurs, says the textbook. Really? They say they have all kinds of fossil evidence to show they have nice, beautiful drawings of reptiles becoming birds. Robert Bakker in his Dinosaur Heresy, 1986, he says, when the Canada geese honk their way northward, we can say, there go the dinosaurs. Dinosaurs are migrating, it must be spring. He honestly believes the birds are the dinosaurs. Believe whatever you want. Listen, reptiles produce a variety of reptiles, there's no question. But to say that a reptile can become a bird requires a religious leap of faith. I'm sorry, we've never seen anything like that happen. You're welcome to believe it. Can you just imagine, to go from a reptile to a bird, the animal is going to end up with useless arms or legs, long before it ends up with useful wings. And it's going to take a lot more than just adding wings to the thing to make it fly. Anyways, it's going to have a whole body designed for flight. You know, you just don't rivet wings on your half ton and hope it'll fly. The whole thing has got to be designed to fly. I work in the aerospace industry. I know what I'm talking about. Reptiles, it just staggers the imagination. You know, the great mystery of our age, how intelligent people can believe this stuff. This scientist says in Science News, he says, the issue of the bird origins continues to occupy center stage among scientists because these animals differ in so many ways from their flightless antecedents, making avian evolution a critical problem to solve. Yeah, I would say it's a problem. How do you get a terrestrial running reptile to become a winged bird, a feathered bird? A lot of scientists recognizing the problem said maybe evolution happens in spurts. Richard Goldschmidt, he hatched the hopeful monster theory. And that was popularized by Stephen Jay Gould. He said maybe birds hatched out of reptile eggs. You know, maybe just, you know, boom, it just happened. So you avoid the problem of the half-formed wings and the useless limbs, okay? I got to say, the genetic hurdles between these two kinds of animals are huge. Feathers have nothing to do with scales. They're completely different. These hooks and barbules, these things are designed for flight. They're designed to repel the water off the bird. Absolutely different in every way than a reptile's scales. And you just take a look at it. They originate in a totally different way. The reptile's scales are his skin, folds in the skin, but a feather it forms in a follicle, like a hair. Completely different. The genetic code would have to be altered in zillions of ways to make this happen. We don't understand what kind of miracle these guys are asking for. Completely different. The scientist says that at the morphological level, feathers are traditionally considered homologous with reptilian scales. However, in development, morphogenesis, that's the shape, the form during generation, gene structure, protein shape and sequence, and filament formation and structure, feathers are different. They are way different. You don't just slap feathers on a reptile and hope it's going to become a bird. It doesn't make any sense at all. Archaeopteryx, you've probably heard of Archaeopteryx, he's considered an intermediate between reptiles and birds. I have a castor that I should have brought it. He's considered an intermediate. He cannot possibly be an intermediate between reptiles and birds. They found 6 specimens of this creature. Only 2, as far as I know, are claimed to have feathers on them. The rest don't have feathers. Both of them were sold for very high prices. They claim that at least one other, you can actually see feathers on it, but these scientists say only people with an exceptional condition of mind can see the feathers. In other words, if you're predisposed to evolution, you'll see the feathers. If you're not, well, you're not going to see them. This animal has feathers, apparently, a wishbone, and it has solid bones, which make it like a reptile. It has features like both. Solid bones, claws on the wings, and a long tail, and teeth like a reptile. This article I got from the University of Winnipeg, it tells us that terrestrial running reptiles had hollow bones before the birds evolved. The birds have hollow bones, okay, for flight, to make them light. But Archaeopteryx had solid bones. So he cannot possibly be on the way to flying. You see what I'm saying? The article says hollow bones were in animals on the ground first. But this guy still has solid bones. Many people think Compsognathus is really he's the running dinosaur that has been made into the Archaeopteryx. These specimens are not particularly like modern birds at all. They would have unquestionably been labeled as the coelurosaurian dinosaurs, such as Compsognathus. In fact, a few of the specimens they thought were that dinosaur, okay, until they saw feathers attached to one of them. It's strikingly similar to Compsognathus. If you take a look at the wishbone on the one specimen, it's been put on upside down. The thing is a fraud. I'm convinced the thing is a complete fraud. The impression doesn't even match on the slab to the counter slab. Fred Hoyle and Chandra Wickramasinghe, they said it was somewhat unwise for the forgers to endow Compsognathus with a furcula, or that's the wishbone, because the cavity had to be cut in the counter slab with at least some semblance to providing a fit to the added bone, and it just didn't happen. You can see that these things don't match slab to counter slab. Okay? The feather impressions are mainly on the one slab. They're raised impressions that don't have a corresponding depression on the other slab. Their texture is completely different too. Underneath the feather impressions, you get the fine-grained looking limestone, which is the same chemicals as concrete, by the way. The rest of the fossil is the coarse-grained stuff. Someone has added feathers to this fossil. As a matter of fact, the feather impressions on the one slab don't match the feathers on the other slab. These guys were playing around with wet concrete trying to make feathers on their forgery, and it didn't quite work. This scientist says there is little justification for continuing to classify Archaeopteryx as a bird. He says it's not ancestral to birds, nor is it the ideal intermediate. It's not a bird. As a matter of fact, even if you thought it was a bird, we have real evidence for birds in the fossil record 55 million years before Archaeopteryx ever showed up. That's the secular science who says that. He cannot possibly be a missing link. Okay, these missing links come and go. This is an article on the Archaeoraptor. National Geographic had a big article on this thing, a feathered dinosaur. They had to recount the whole thing a year later. It was another fraud. You know, they're just quick to run away with this. The Smithsonian Institute said the National Geographic has reached an all-time low for engaging in sensationalistic, unsubstantiated tabloid journalism. Okay, you know, it's just like the Piltdown Man, you know, years ago. Another fraud that destroyed people's faith. They're just making these things and putting them together. And for 40 years, people thought Piltdown Man was a real missing link. And I wonder how many guys had their faith in God destroyed. Fact is, the true origin of birds is still up in the air. We have only a couple minutes to talk about whale evolution. I'd love to go for days on this, but we just can't. Fact or fable? Have all kinds of pictures. How can a running terrestrial mammal become this largest animal you've ever laid eyes on, the most conspicuous thing you've ever seen? How on earth could this have happened? Whales are so amazingly complex. Their bodies are so unique. So many interdependent systems and structures to let this thing go down a 10,000 feet and stay down there for 2 hours and come up quickly without getting the bends. How is that possible? Just read about it. It's incredible. Jacques Cousteau said the cranium of these animals differs from the standard mammalian skull in a number of ways. He said the trail and trunk vertebrae are distinctive also. Wow, and then he goes on and says, well, look what evolution has done. You know, but when he finds similarities to terrestrial mammals, he says, oh, that's proof of evolution. So you find differences, that's proof of evolution. If you find similarities, that's also proof for evolution. Oh, I see. I see how that works. Okay. Here's a mom and her calf. The mom has to suckle her calf underwater, and she is specially designed to pump blood down the calf's throat so he won't choke. I want to say, while evolution was experimenting, it had better get that experiment right the first time. Otherwise, that's the end of whale evolution. You see what I'm saying? These things have got to evolve like that. But it's so complex, it's just incredible to imagine. Jacques Cousteau said, since the oldest known archaeocetes already had an ear similar to that of modern species, all we know about the evolution of hearing in whales is that it occurred eons ago. That's all they know. See, whales have a great sense of hearing. They have a lousy sense of smell. But he just said, we don't know how that could have happened. As far as the missing links go, there's just not enough time. Based on the evolution's dating of some of these things, 5 million years is not going to be enough time to make some of these things happen. We're asking for a miracle. Can you see that? What we're asking for here? Sometimes these guys are really deceptive. Here, all they found was some skull fragments of this guy, and they put together a whole missing link. The guy at the bottom there, he's 10 times larger than his ancestor. And this is supposed to happen in just over a couple of million years. But they draw them the same size. You see that? That's deceptive. 10 times the size, 70 feet long, for heaven's sakes. This scientist, he's writing for McGraw-Hill, he says this animal could not possibly have been ancestor of modern whales, and yet they're still propagating it in other textbooks. Okay, fossil skulls indicate that Bacillosaurus had, and other archaeocetes still had fairly well-developed olfactory pendicles. This, their smell. But as they adapted to marine life, the sense of smell was gradually replaced. He's saying whales have a lousy sense of smell, but all these other things seem to have a great sense of smell. Look what evolution did. They're not ancestral to whales, okay? Pachycetus is said to be our ancestor to the bird, or to the whales, right? Look what they drew on the left there. Look what they actually found. A couple skull fragments, and they drew the whole thing. Unbelievable. That's probably more like it. You know, more complete skeletal remains have been found since, and he's just a running terrestrial mammal. It had nothing to do with aquatic animals at all. Okay, I heard some scientists say, you go to different anti-creation websites, they're going to say they found whales with legs on them, vestigial hind legs. This is a 5.5-inch bone growth they found on a 60-foot whale, sperm whale. That is not a leg, folks. That's a bone growth. You know, the next time I get a bunion or something, I'll just be like, oh, look at that, I'm got another leg. I got 3 legs. Oh, ridiculous. I mean, wow. I'd like to say, even if that is a vestigial leg, even if whales used to have limbs back there, it doesn't mean they evolved from terrestrial running mammals. It means they used to have something back there. They don't have anymore. They lost something. That is the opposite for evolution. Evolution requires that you gain things. Okay? I mean, how does evolution work anyway? You just keep losing stuff till you have it all? Is that how it goes? Here's some examples of animals that lost things. Mutations have crept in. The eyeless newt and the sightless cavefish don't need eyes. They live in the dark. So when the mutation crept into the population, it was perfectly fine to lose your eyes because they didn't use them anyways. Okay? The flightless beetle lived on a windy island. Not being able to fly came in handy. He doesn't get swept out to sea by the wind. But the fact is, they all lost something. It's not evolution. Sometimes animals, a mutation will misplace body parts. Okay? Here's the Drosophila fruit fly. His antenna are sticking out, or his legs are sticking out of where his antennas should be. But that's just scrambling information that's already there. Nothing new. Okay? I saw this x-ray on the internet. It shows what look like bones and joints in the hindquarters of a whale. To me, that's not evidence that the whale used to have legs and used to run around on the ground. To me, it might be a misplaced flipper. Maybe it's a mutation. You know, it might be that I just watched a show yesterday on the Learning Channel about mutations in people. You know, this might be a malformed and a misplaced flipper on this whale. Okay? Or maybe it is truly a vestigial hind limb of some sort. Maybe it was used in copulation or something. I don't know. But this is definitely not the knockdown, drag them out evidence for evolution that they're trying to claim. For whales to evolve the way they say, they have to span these enormous genetic hurdles. You've got to remember that the fossils are extremely fragmentary. They really don't know how old those things are. We'll get to that. I think just session before the last one, we'll get to that. To me, the Earth appears young anyways. There's not enough time to make these things happen. And the vestigial legs are subject to all kinds of interpretation, okay? Whales did not evolve from land mammals, I'm sure. This Competent Encyclopedia says, the evolutionary origin of whales remains controversial among zoologists. I agree. They really don't know. As far as I'm concerned, God did all of it, and he did it the way he said. This creation requires a creator, and that creator is, like I said before, he is not nameless or faceless. He did not create everything and then back off and let everything do what it wants to do. He is intimately involved and concerned about his creation, especially us, the apex of his creation. So concerned was he that the creator came down here as a man, and the word became flesh, the Bible says, and Jesus walked among us. And the Bible says God spoke to us through his son in these last days, and that's what these seminars are all about. It's not about filling our heads full of all kinds of science facts. It's about taking God at his word and trusting his son. God so loved this world that the son not only came down here to show us what God was like, but he came down here to die for us, to pay our sin debt. Greater love hath no man than this, than to lay down his life for his friends. In the next session, we're going to talk about God's special creation, people made in his image and likeness. We are not just chemicals dancing to our DNA, as some scientists try to say. We are much more than that, and we all know it. Much more than that. I love this picture. This little baby, 21 weeks old, in the womb, holding on to the doctor's finger. And they operated on baby Samuel, and he turned out just fine. But can you look at that? Amazing. Being knit together in the womb, just like God said. We are special. Don't let anyone ever tell you different. God says, you are so special, I will never leave you or forsake you. What a Savior, what a God that we have. That is it for this session, folks. I'm glad that you sat to listen. I have much more information on all this on our website. And if you want to watch it again, get the DVD. I hope to see you all back next time for the next session. Thank you.